Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang, proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Pantheon from Rio Grande and Quack in the Box from Don Cusano Games. Jeff will be reviewing Sekigahara from GMT and Fantasy Craft from Crafty Games. We'll have news, views, and more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
And here we are once again. Yes, another show. As we now venture into our second year of doing all this stuff.
Yeah, and such a lot of stuff it is.
Such a lot of stuff it is. Before we get into the news, I know someone is having their second annual Miller Gaming Festival. What exactly is the name of that?
I believe it is the Miller Game Weekend.
You believe it
is? I call it the Miller Minicon. Yeah.
Now, this is by invitation only, isn't it?
It's true. Yes. Special.
Too bad I didn't get an invite.
Yeah, well, you know.
Hey, I understand it's invitation only.
That's right.
Yep. Well, that's the end of the show, everybody. Thanks for
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Yes, so we're getting together, me, the kids, my nieces and nephews, and these are all teenage and up, for a weekend out in beautiful Mount Carroll, Illinois, where we are going to game away.
The entire weekend. It runs Friday through Sunday, doesn't it?
Yep, the 7th.
That's what I thought. Very nice. Second annual.
Last year's went very well. You know, it's funny because this will be like the first time I've played Arkham Horror since the last one.
My gosh, you let an entire year go by without playing Arkham Horror?
Yeah, I did. I was like, this weekend's all about playing the games that I've been wanting to play again.
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 I'm glad to hear that you've got the big Miller Gaming Weekend planned. Myself, nothing too thrilling going on, although as of October 1st, I do believe I should be able to get a lot more gaming in just because of some changes in what's going on out here in Arizona. So that'll be pretty cool. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, gaming's fun. You know,
I like. Yes.
It's funny that we would end up doing a podcast and we both like gaming so much, you know?
I know. Isn't it amazing?
It's pretty cool.
All right. Let's move on to the news.
Excellent.
Good evening, Mr. Mr. North and South American. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France. Flash.
Hot on the heels of their entrance into the deck-building game market with Resident Evil, Bandai is bringing Star Trek The Next Generation deck-building game to store shelves. That's kind of a mouthful. Just in time for Halloween, you'll be able to go where no deck-building game has gone before, with 300 cards representing characters, starships, situations, and more from the classic science fiction series. The Star Trek DBG brings the Star Trek The Next Generation universe to life in a game of strategy where players construct their card decks while they play. In the Star Trek DBG, you're the captain of a small starship with a standard crew and basic weaponry. Will you use your crew's experience to improve your ship's systems or to recruit more experienced crewmen to your ship? Will you form diplomatic relationships or conquer civilizations in battle? Build your deck and explore the Star Trek universe. Plans are for the game to consist of the aforementioned 300 cards, plus other accessories that will create a countless number of possible scenarios for unlimited replay value. No two games will ever be the same.
Sweet.
And it's supposedly going to have a retail price of $39.99.
Conquer civilizations. I know the Federation was big on that, taking out half the galaxy. And
oh, of course. They were huge.
Under the iron thumb of the humans.
Iron thumb?
Iron hand? Iron head?
Iron fist.
And I'm hearing that you can combine it with Resident Evil and actually...
Jeez. No, you are not. Are you excited to hear that? I know you're a huge Trek fan.
I am. I was happy to hear it. We'll see how it comes out. I've been burned by card games from Star Trek in the past.
Wasn't it Decipher? Wasn't that who made that one?
Yes, I still have several boxes of the collectible card game. STTNGCCG. Which is actually easier to say than STTNGDBG.
There isn't a whole lot of information out there about the game, but it appears as if you'll be able to play Klingons or Romulans or whatever. It's not everyone is the Federation. I guess you could have conquering civilizations. I don't know.
I have no idea. Well, it says there's nothing wrong with conquering civilizations.
No, I know. I understand. I think it would be pretty difficult to do that with an entire civilization if you're just the captain of a small starship, but that's just me.
Hey, man, Kirk could do anything. Asmodee Editions has added their game Identic to the Gaming Gang Birthday Scavenger Hunt. Hey, hey.
Wow. That makes 13
games. 13. Lucky 13 we're up to. To one single winner. We'll take home all of this. If you've already entered, don't worry. You're still qualified for entry to win all of the prizes. If you've been waiting for the pot to sweeten, you'd better wait no longer. So there. And remember, the contest runs throughout September, after which we will draw a single winner from all the correct entries.
And they must be correct.
Yep. Visit the Gaming Gang Birthday Scavenger Hunt page on our site,
and you could win. Tell you one thing, I have been very surprised.
What's that?
There have been quite a lot of entries with incorrect answers.
Really?
Yes. And I didn't think it was all that difficult. And a lot of the comments that we've received, both on the website or through email or even over on BoardGameGeek, a lot of people were saying, hey, you know, that was a lot of fun. I got to find out about games and companies I wasn't familiar with. And it was kind of like a little Easter egg hunt.
Yeah, so it was cool.
I thought that was... Yeah,
I was surprised that a lot of people will visit it, but they just can't be bothered to go through the effort of looking, you know, and submitting the
entry. I thought that was kind of strange, too. Right now, I believe we're running about 25% of the people who look over the actual contest page go to the entry form and complete
it. Yeah, and you know, what is it, like $600 worth of games at least now?
Gosh, yeah, it's about that much, I would think.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's very, very sweet. Well, you can't have them. Sorry. Tomb of Ichiban by AEG is a new take on the original Tomb board game. Tomb of Ichiban, which I, of course, am mispronouncing, you know me, places players into the honor-based world of Legend of the Five Rings, following rules you may already be familiar with from Tomb. Recruit a party, defend your honor, fight for glory. Tomb of Ichiban is a complete new game using the tomb rules in the world of Legend of the Five Rings and an exciting empire of Rokugan. Contained within are new rules for family honor, clan loyalty, dueling between characters, and mastery of the five fundamental elements, and will play in approximately 2 hours. We should be seeing this in stores soon. As soon as we find out when the release date will be, we will let everyone know.
This is one of the ones he was hinting towards, right?
Who's he?
I'm sorry. Todd Rowland from AEG?
Yes, correct.
I believe you were suspecting this.
I had actually heard about this, believe it or not, almost a year ago, maybe 10 months ago. And I believe that the prototype version of it that they had, they weren't completely satisfied with. So I think they went back to the drawing board. I'm not sure if they went completely back to the drawing board or if they just revised quite a lot of it. But I do know that there have been a lot of people asking what had happened to the game. And this kind of just came out of the blue and said, hey, guess what? Here it comes.
You know, it's funny. I'm getting ready to play test the For the Crown expansion from Victory Point.
Yes, our good friends over at Victory Point Games. Speaking of Victory Point Games and playtesting, they're also looking for playtesters for their expansion to the Battle of Four Armies. So there are two expansions that are looking for playtesters. And VPG's always looking for people to playtest their games. If anyone's interested, you don't have to be an experienced playtester or anything along those lines. There's a page that just talks about being a playtester. So they expect you to play it multiple times and to send comments and critiques and questions and things like that. It's not just a way to score yourself a free prototype game.
Well, yes, of course. They're going to be adding more armies to Battle of Four Armies.
I don't know.
Will they, in fact, change the name?
Battle of 47 Armies.
So, did you know Elder Sign has hit the store shelf?
I did know that. I did know Elder Sign is out there
in
stores.
Yes, Fantasy Flight Games is shipping the latest Cthulhu Mythos title, Elder Sign, to your local friendly Elf FGS, to your friendly local game store. The game promises to bring much of the Lovecraftian action and adventure of Arkham Horror to the gaming table, but is easily playable within 1 to 2 hours. Moot, I said. Elder Sign is a fast-paced cooperative dice game of supernatural intrigue for 1 to 8 players. And it's also by Richard Lanius and Kevin Wilson, the designers of Arkham Horror. Players take the role of investigators racing against time to stave off the imminent return of the Ancient One. Sound familiar?
Sounds familiar.
Armed with tools, allies, and occult knowledge, like a hoe, pick. Sorry. Investigators must put their sanity and stamina to the test as they adventure to locate Elder Signs, the eldritch symbols used to seal away the Ancient Ones and win the game. That's what I'm looking for. Finally getting a copy. That I could have bought at Chink.
That's right. Who are you going to blame now? Speaking of Fantasy Flight Games, they've also announced an expansion to Sid Meier's Civilization, the board game. It will be entitled Fame and Fortune. Something that Elliot doesn't have to worry about. He has both.
Okay.
It will also allow for, ready for this, up to 5 players. Excellent. That's what I believe you were commenting during your review of the game, that you wish that there was a 5th player. There's also going to be more civilizations that you'll be able to develop at the table at the same time. Master the world with the Fame and Fortune expansion for Sid Meier's Civilization, the board game. With exciting new game options, new map tiles, and components for that magical 5th player, Fame and Fortune will bring your civilization to remarkable new heights. Great person cards provide the powerful assistance of Marco Polo, Hannibal, and a host of other great historical figures, while investment cards allow you to spend your hard-earned coin to reap lasting benefits. Discover ancient relics, expand your capital city into a metropolis, I guess that means Superman's going to live there, and bolster your cities with temporary fortifications or trade caravans to edge out your rivals. The time has come to guide your people to greatness. You'll see 4 new civilizations, including the Arabs, the Spanish, the Greeks, and the Indians.
Together at last.
All with their... It's two mints in one. And you'll have over 150 cards, 120 markers and tokens, 11 map tiles, 4 civilization sheets, 9 plastic playing pieces, and more. We should be seeing Fame and Fortune in the 4th quarter of this year.
Sweet. Coming next month from Asmodee is Hatari, a clue-like deduction game with some bluffing, too. It came over from Japan and promises excitement for all or some. I don't really know, but...
Which is it, all or some?
But not none.
Someone will enjoy it.
I don't really know much about it, but here is the info from Asmodee. It's for 3 to 4 players only, though.
Yeah.
Ouch. So Hatari comes from Japan, brought over in a suitcase carried by Moonster Games.
What, did they steal it?
I think they did. I think I'm confessing them right here.
You're outing their nefarious plans.
This game of deduction and bluffing might seem a little alien to Western gamers. This version has been graphically reworked by Ian Perovel, and he did a remarkable job of retaining the spirit of this Japanese treasure. Playing Hatari is almost a ritual. Between the graphics and the pieces, it's like a tea ceremony in a game box. The changing dynamic will lead to constantly questioning the motives of the other players. If a player is close to losing, he will risk the bluff and try to saddle the others with some negative points. Or will he play it safe and make the most educated guess? Games of Hatari are short but intense. The combination of deduction, bluffing, with gameplay that changes depending on turn order, makes Hatari a game that will blow your mind. And if you're going to Essen in October, you can meet Jun Sasaki, the creator of Hatari. He's coming out just to meet his Western fans and sign some copies.
I don't know. It's an old game. I remember when we were kids, we all had Hatari 2600s.
I do remember that.
Ba-dun-dun-sh. This square is a dragon, and this square over here, that's a knight, see? Because he's got this little stick. It's supposed to be a sword. Gary Games has announced their 2nd expansion to Ascension. It will be called Storm of Souls, and it's a full-sized expansion with 200 cards and 50 deluxe honor tokens. Samael is dead, but a storm is still raging across Vigil. This November, Ascension Storm of Souls takes players into the chaos following the Fallen One's demise. As Samael's monsters run wild and his minions conspire, the world is slowly being overtaken with souls that should have moved on. Are you ready for the new challenges that Vigil's future holds? Storm of Souls is playable standalone and is for 1-4 players, or you can add it with either Ascension game to have it up to 6 players. You'll be able to pick up Ascension Storm of Souls in November.
I'm going to get it just for the deluxe honor token. There's nothing like having deluxe honor tokens, let me tell you. I know we haven't mentioned Fantasy Flight Games much, but
No, we never really do.
But, you know, Forbidden Alchemy is going to be the first big box expansion to Mansions of Madness. 2 new monsters, 4 new investigators, and 3 new scenarios.
Puzzles,
too, that can have dire consequences if you fail. Snap your hands off. The expansion is due out this year. Inside abandoned hospitals, secret laboratories, and forgotten cellars, scientists are conducting depraved experiments that will drag humanity to the brink of the abyss. Only a small group of investigators can discover the truth and put an end to these mad plots before it's too late. Fantasy Flight Games is pleased to announce the upcoming release of Forbidden Alchemy, an expansion that adds even more mystery and horror to your Mansions of Madness experience. This exciting expansion provides players with new investigators, as well as new trauma, mythos, and combat cards for the use in any story. Forbidden Alchemy also includes 3 new tales of scientific horrors, in which investigators will encounter new rooms, monsters, items, clues, locks, and obstacles. Try to solve the new alchemy puzzles, if you dare. The side effects may prove deadly.
To me personally? The only board game that could kill you.
With 4 clever new investigators, 2 terrifying monster types, nearly 250 new cards, 40 tokens and markers, and 6 detailed map tiles, Forbidden Alchemy introduces a host of new enchantments to your Mansions of Madness experience.
Does this also mean there's going to be more figures for me to paint for you?
But there's only 2 new monsters. 4 new investigators, though. I have to ship those over.
Okay, so 4 new investigators, maybe 2 of each monster. Oh, okay.
Yep. Looks like a Bakashi, another thing.
Was that the actual Lovecraft name for it? Other
the thing from the other.
It was indescribable. And then he goes on to try to describe it.
That's true.
Dan Versen Games has 2 new titles on their way next month. 2! U-Boat Leader and Killshot. U-Boat Leader is going to be the Battle of the Atlantic, so you'll get to experience World War II firsthand. Killshot is a party game in which players hunt down terrorists. The Battle of the Atlantic was the longest continuous campaign of World War II, and it ran from 1939 on through the defeat of Germany in 1945. It involved thousands of ships, stretched over hundreds of miles of ocean, and involved hundreds of convoy battles and single ship encounters. During the struggle, advantage switched back and forth between the U-boats and the Allies as new weapons, tactics, and countermeasures were developed and implemented. U-Boat Leader takes the Leader series to new depths, pun intended, letting players control a group of U-boats on missions in the Atlantic. Of course, this should be a solitaire game because the Leader series, like Phantom Leader or Hornet Leader, those tend to be solitaire games. So this looks pretty cool. Killshot is an ultra-fast-paced game with terrorist hunts taking only 1 to 2 minutes. An entire terrorist campaign takes less than 20 minutes. Killshot is a speed card game played in real time, like a firefight. As you and your friends frantically throw down cards, you'll scream manly phrases like, "Cover me! Jam! Reloading!" And of course, the ultimate headshot. It's going to be kind of a party game, convention game, and it'll be a game you can play with your non-gamer friends who no doubt hate terrorists. Both of those games, U-Boat Leader and Killshot, should be in stores in October.
Big month, right before Christmas season.
One last news piece before we get into the reviews, and it's mainly for those gamers who are here in the Phoenix Valley. Our pals who are behind the upcoming Volcon 2012 convention have a Back to Basics D&D event scheduled for October 29th. It's a combination 70s costume party and D&D gaming event to be held at Imperial Outpost Games / Mana Works in Glendale, Arizona. This charity fundraiser event will include a costume contest for the best 70s outfit, and they'll have different categories, and D&D gaming using the late 1970s basic set for the rules and the modules that were included in it in 78 and 79. Module B1, In Search of the Unknown, and B2, The Keep on the Borderlands. Seats at the gaming tables for the event are limited, so you want to go to vul-con.com to lock in your place. Also at the event, they're going to be joined by Mike Carr via Skype. They're really excited about this because they're going to interview Mr. Carr, and he happens to be one of the last survivors of the group that developed the original D&D
set. Yes, the dreaded D&D curse hasn't reached him. Oh,
what
my
gosh.
D&D
you didn't curse.
Know about the D&D curse?
I think it's called age. Come on. The dreaded. Are you being serious or are you just joking around? Whoa, it's worse than the curse of King Tut.
Six of the creators are dead.
I don't think there were there six people that, even involved in it? I thought there were
thin air.
Three or four. It wasn't thin air you pulled it out of. Mr. Carr wrote In Search of the Unknown and was one of the early editors for TSR. His editing credits for D&D include the original Monster Manual, Vault of the Drow, Player's Handbook, White Plume Mountain, The Village of Hamlet, gosh, I remember that one, The World of Greyhawk, The Keep on the Borderlands, Descent into the Depths of the Earth, Against the Giants, and Deep Dwarven Delve, which actually wasn't printed until 1999. He's also the creator of the game Fight in the Skies, which was also known as Dawn Patrol. The entrance fee for the event is absolutely free, but you want to bring along some money as it is a fundraising event for Tracy's Tooth Fairy. It's a charity that's focused on helping cancer patients, and there are going to be opportunities for gamers to donate by purchasing in-game potions and magic. There's going to be raffle tickets, merchandise, and more. I am not, as everyone knows, the biggest D&D gamer out there, but I am going to swing out for the Back to Basics D&D event just to...
That actually sounds pretty cool because actually the D&D that we started with.
No, actually, that would not be what I had started with.
You're talking about the original chainmail?
No, actually, the original Dungeons & Dragons I started with was Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
I thought this was all how it came out in... This is with the light blue cover rule book?
This is the one that was the boxed edition.
I'm pretty sure I had that.
Maybe you did, but that's not what I had played. I played Advanced.
Well, I mean, I got all the manuals after they came out, but I mean, they came out almost right away. But
right.
I had that Monster Manual.
Oh my gosh, we had all that stuff.
Those were the
days. Oh, yes. Oh, well. Sadness. Yes, those were the days. And just think, if we had kept those and they were in nice condition, you and I would just be sitting pretty. So, Mr. Miller, how did you make your first million? Well, I had all these games. There is the news for this time around with plenty of nonsense included with that as well. Let's move on to our reviews.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game reviews. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
The first game I'm going to talk about is Pantheon from Rio Grande via Hansim Gluck. It was designed by Brund Brunhofer. Came out in 2011. It's for 2 to 4 players. Game takes an hour and a half at most to play. You know, so every once in a while, I get to play a game that reminds me that some Euro games are actually fun.
The hell you say?
It's true. I was shocked.
It is kind of funny how we really have tried to enjoy a lot of the different Euro games that are out there. And we don't really review a whole lot of them because, I don't know, myself personally, I've found many of them kind of wanting, sort of boring.
Boring, yes, exactly. There are good ones out there. I mean,
Agricola.
And along those lines. So this one reminded me that, yes, you can actually have fun playing Euro games. On opening the box, you'll come across a plethora of game components, all of them very good quality and have some excellent artwork. And it even includes a nice cloth drawstring bag, which I haven't seen in a game in a while.
Really?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Wow, okay.
The object of the game is, of course, to get the most victory points. The premise of the game is that you're gaining the favor of the gods as you move through six different epochs centered around six different civilizations. Now, the rules are a bit daunting at first, and it wasn't until I actually sat down and played a game by myself that it all clicked. It takes a few minutes to set up, and then you'll begin the first epoch by drawing one of the eight civilization cards. You place a wooden temple at the starting location of the civilization on the board, pull booty tiles from the bag, yep, they got booty tiles, to place in the marked locations around the temple. Players start with five cards. The cards are critical in the beginning, but you lessen their importance as the game goes on. The cards will contain either one of the four sacrifice suits. Sacrifice suits, because you make sacrifices to the gods. So basically, it's like set collecting.
Okay.
Gifts, priests, dancers, and temples.
I wouldn't be sacrificing any dancers.
Yeah, well, you might have to, you know.
Bow, da, da, bow, bow.
You can get a movement card or you can get coins. The sacrifice cards are the most plentiful by far, and by collecting sets of these cards, you can trade them in to gain the god tiles. There's 10 different gods in the god tiles that you can gain during the game, and each one of these god tiles will provide you with a certain benefit, and the effects are cumulative. So if you get two Vrinthrad tiles...
Gesundheit.
It's funny, he looks like Thor to me, but, you know, what do I know? You'll gain a free movement point for each one that you collect.
So you could have two additional movement points.
There you go. You could get four of them. See? A player's turn boils down to one of four actions. You can perform movement by using movement cards and your available feet and columns. See, the game comes with all these little wooden feets.
Mm-hmm.
And plus little wooden columns in four different player colors.
Feet, so, don't let me down!
And you're laying footprints with the goal of reaching one of the nearby booty tokens, which are scattered around the board.
Why does this game sound so dirty?
Well, this is, you know...
You've got dancers, you've got booty.
We got booty, man. Your columns can only be placed on the column spots on the board. The feet tokens will be removed and returned to you at the end of each epoch, but the columns stay on the board. These get you more victory points the more you place, but be careful, if you choose movement, the other players also get to move if they wish. So you may instead choose the buy action. You can spend your coins to gain extra feet, columns, sacrifice tiles, which replace sacrifice cards, and those don't get discarded. Or you can buy movement points. You can choose to gain a god tile by discarding the right amount of cards or using your tiles, your sacrifice tiles. If you gain a god tile, you immediately score a number of victory points matching the epic you're in. So if it's epic 1, you get 1 point. If it's epic 6, you get 6.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, you can choose to draw 3 cards. An epic continues until a player grabs the last booty tile off the board or gets the last available god tile, at which point you grab up all of your feet. A new civilization card is drawn, new gods come out, and new booty tokens. If it's after the third epoch, you score for columns and any minor god tokens you've managed to pick up. The same happens after the sixth, with the difference being that the game ends after the final scoring, and the player with the highest score wins. The first turn takes the greatest portion of time in the game. You really have no resources and have to spend some time planning a strategy to execute for the rest of the game. After the first turn, the game speeds up turn by turn until the last epic is over before you even know it. In fact, the last epic might end with each player only getting one turn. I was able to teach this game easily by simply running through the first epic explaining as I went. By the second epic, everybody knew how to play and were figuring out their own strategies. There's a lot here that I haven't touched on. The game has different strategies you can pursue that will be changed depending on the bonuses that you get, or the cards that you draw, the civilizations that come up, and the gods that you manage to get. The game's pretty deep and seems complex, but it really isn't. It's got loads of replayability and plenty of chances to come from behind. I like this game a lot. It's fun, it's full of options, and it's one of those games that encourages you to try different strategies. I thought for sure that my strategy of getting several level 4 sacrifice tiles so that I could buy a new god every turn was unbeatable. And I came in last place in that.
Nice.
So it needs a little refinement.
The strategy, not the game.
Exactly. The rules complicate things, but if you play the game and go through the rules, it all becomes pretty clear. So all in all, it was a pretty good game and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm kind of confused. I don't really understand what the point of the game is.
There is no point, man.
Okay.
Well, basically, okay, all you do is you move around the board by placing these little feet to move from space to space. When you run out of feet, you can't move any further. And you're trying to get to these little booty tokens. You get a booty token, that's like collecting a certain treasure, you know?
Right. Okay. So you're collecting these treasures and then you're trading the treasures in to get the favor of the gods, the various different gods?
Yeah. The whole thing that you want to do is pick up some of these booty tokens, do different things, like they'll give you a minor god who basically gets you extra victory points, or they'll give you an extra foot, you know, so you can move one extra every turn. And it's all building towards getting these victory points.
Right. And, okay.
Getting the highest score from all your victory points as each epic goes through. And it was fun. Got a lot of depth for something that is really easy once you learn how to actually play it.
Speaking of Euros, granted, it's an older one, but I was finally able to pick up a copy of Stone Age. So I am looking forward to trying that out because a lot of people have said it's a really great game.
You know, that's what I've heard too. I've never had a chance to play it.
No, neither have I. So I'm looking forward to checking that out. The first title I'm going to take a look at is Sekigahara, The Unification of Japan from GMT. I would consider putting this in a war room segment because it is, I guess, technically a war game, but there's a lot to it that takes it a little bit out of what's considered a traditional war game. And you have to give kudos to GMT because GMT is always looking at different ways to expand the hobby and to create interest in conflict games that are not just the traditional 5-3-4 counter kind of games. It is a two-player game designed by Matt Calkins, and it is a block game, so there is a fog of war component to it, and it's point-to-point movement. What the game is, it's actually a representation of the campaign that led to the unification of Japan in 1600. One player is going to take on the role of the most powerful warlord of Japan of that time, while the other player takes on the champion of the child who was supposedly the legitimate heir to the throne. I'm not going to go into a lot of details about the different characters and so forth because I'm lucky I can pronounce English words. I don't want to embarrass myself trying to pronounce various different Japanese historical figures and so forth.
It would work, though, if you did it as George Takei. It would come off.
There we go. I only pulled off that impersonation one time when we were joking around before we had to record a show. And I've never been able to do it since. But I had you busting up pretty good. Once you open the box, you're going to find loads of blocks, cards, a mounted map, two player aids, and of course the rule book. The map is of central Japan, and it's a very striking design, and it notates resource areas and castles. The game is designed with a point-to-point movement system, and the areas of movement are clearly defined. The blocks represent various different armies of the different daimos of the day and are colored either black or gold to designate which side of the conflict these armies will be recruited into. As the game progresses, you're going to find more and more of these blocks are added to each player's forces. And while the blocks look like they might be a little bit too large and unwieldy, it turns out that the size decision works really well since you're going to find many of your forces are going to consist of 10 or 11, 12 or more blocks. They're actually pretty easy to stack and maneuver. As we would normally expect from GMT, along with very nice components, the rule book is comprehensive, although gameplay is simple enough, and it also does include examples of play along with some historical info regarding the Battle of Sekigahara and the campaign that led to the decisive battle in 1600. One thing I have noticed, and I will point this out about GMT releases, which include wooden blocks, is the issue with storage. You find it's a bit of a bother because you have to make sure you arrange all of the blocks and the cards and other materials in a proper order inside the box so you can close it.
Huh. Hmm.
Yeah, you really have to play around to find a system that's going to work to be able to put all of those in there. All in all, though, the components are what we know we're going to see with just about each and every release from GMT. The game plays rather quickly. You should be able to finish up in about 2 or maybe even 2.5 hours. You play out 7 turns. Each of these turns will consist of 2 movement and combat phases. Once you have the rather simple and concise rules under your belt, it's a pretty fast play. You can teach the game in probably about 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Yeah, because the rules are simple. And the most complex of the rules is combat, which is card-based. But there's an example of play in the rule book that just irons it all out. You don't have a lot of exceptions to the rules, and there were only, I don't know, a couple of little special rules that you had to keep in mind, for an example, like sieges and things like that. There is some randomness involved in the game because it also comes with two cloth drawstring bags.
Wow.
Yes, that's why when you said, wow, I don't see too many games with... I'm kind of like, well, wait a second. I have tons of games.
I'm sitting on a mountain of drawstring bags.
I'm so tired of all these bags. The starting armies are pretty much predetermined. So you'll have certain blocks that you'll start the game with pretty much every time. Every army that you draw from that afterwards is going to be random. So you actually reach into your bag, which has your troops in it, to pull them out when you're getting reinforcements. It is card driven in a certain respect, but it's not a traditional GMT card driven game. Because what the cards actually represent is the loyalty of the troops that you have and to be able to put those armies into play. So you could have a stack of these armies moving around, but if you don't actually have the card to be able to play them, to commit them to battle, all they're there for is effectively
pillaging, looting.
No, well, yeah, for the most part, or to control an area. If you have armies of the same daimyo, you'll get a bonus, which can really be a big deal. As I mentioned, though, you have to have a matching card to be able to play it. So you do have some limited resources. Plus, when these blocks are eliminated in combat, they're gone. There is no resupply or reinforcements to
bring units back.
Well, yeah, I understand that. I really enjoyed the game because, as I mentioned, it's very quick to learn. It's got a lot behind the scenes to it. One of the reasons why they decided to go with this card-based system of deploying troops is because at the Battle of Sekigahara, there were a lot of, and in fact, I guess in the campaign that led up to this decisive battle, there were a lot of different warlords who were just switching sides left and right. So you can actually play a card to steal away troops from your enemy, and they actually join your army.
Oh, nice.
And the different armies, some of them are cavalry, some of them actually have guns. Of course, we're talking 17th century firearms and so forth. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going for the game, but there are a few things that are a little sticky about the game, which kind of brings its score down, in my opinion. One of them is the map itself. The map is cool and it's very, very nice size, and you can maneuver around it with all these different blocks for the most part without any problems, except for a particular area around Osaka.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cramped and there's castles there, there's resources there. So you find when you're playing, that tends to be an area that naturally draws in the various different forces to battle it out. And it can be a real pain getting them all to kind of squeeze into this area. So it can be a little bit of a hassle. The other thing that kind of struck me about the game is it doesn't have a lot of theme.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really nice looking game. The components are great. It's very striking design. I noticed GMT is really kind of pushing the envelope as far as some of the box art that you've been using lately. It's a really nice looking game, but when you're playing it, you really don't feel as if you're representing a warlord in Japan. It could be anything. You could take this system and superimpose it into a science fiction game or modern war or whatever. It suffers a little bit as far as theme goes. But that's not to say that people shouldn't get the game and try it out. It's a great introductory game to GMT for people who may want to check out a war game, but they're not into the whole let's move around hundreds of stacks of counters and things like that. It is a lot of fun, great introductory war game, although you want to keep in mind you're going to have kind of a bottleneck on the map at one point. And that it's a little weak as far as it goes with the theme.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm kind of experiencing a little bit of the same thing with the Conquest of Narrath. Yeah,
really?
Which I'll be reviewing soon. But I've been playing it, trying it out. It's got so many figures. It's really cool. But it's hard to fit them all in the little lands on the map. You know, it's almost like a Risk map. And you got to fit them all.
Right, right.
You can have a lot of things pop it in there. So where it gets so crowded that I actually will move a hex's worth of battle off to the side, not a hex, but an area, off to the side.
Right.
So we can have the battle on the side and then put the survivors back in the box because it's just easier. And they do give you little chips, like you can stack them all up, but yeah.
Wasn't that a little bit of an issue, too, with War of the Ring?
Yeah, War of the Ring, same problem, the exact same. And they didn't give you little chips to put under them.
Replacements.
Right.
As far as, it's not a huge issue, but it just does seem to be, because one of the primary goals of the game is to capture Osaka Castle. You're normally going to be trying to take that castle.
Right.
It is a victory condition. So you are going to find that you're going to like be packing a lot of units into this area. But it's a lot of fun. It's a very cool game. I liked it a lot.
Cool. So I'm going to talk about Quack in the Box.
Quack in the Box? What is that, about ducks?
No, not at all. It's from Don Gusano Games, and it was designed by an MD.
Really? Who?
I really don't know. Just says an MD. So there you go.
Maybe it was Doctor Who?
Doctor Who?
Maybe the designer just goes by the moniker of the Doctor.
Doctor?
Yes, that's me.
Came out in 2010, and it's for 2 to 6 players. This is an interesting little card game. Not a lot of people have heard of it.
It's got
a theme that I haven't seen used before. In Quack in the Box, each player is a doctor who treats patients and attempts to cure them. And if you manage it, then you get to collect the cash and have the satisfaction of a job well done.
So are you saying that doctors don't collect cash unless they cure you?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Obviously, this must be designed by a doctor.
If, however, they leave in a body bag, which happens more often than not, then you can expect to be lynched by an angry mob. The object of the game is to have the most money at the end. You can push your luck and keep trying to cure patients, or you can take what you've earned so far and head to Switzerland, locking in your earnings and staying one step ahead of the angry mob. To actually play the game, you're going to need to get your own die, score sheet, and pencil. Sorry, not included.
What?
It's true. Just comes in a little small, like, deck box.
So they couldn't squeeze a die in there?
What can I tell you? Most of us have them lying about in abundance, so you separate the cards into two piles, the patient deck and the doctor deck. All the cards not in the patient deck is basically the doctor deck. As for the cards themselves, they have decent artwork, and they're a little bit thinner than a regular playing card. Each player gets 6 cards from the doctor deck, and you're all set to play. Game turn is separated into 6 different phases. In phase 1 is where you choose whether you're going to flee the country to Switzerland. So if you're at that point where your infamy is getting so bad that you're in danger of being out of the game, then that's when you take off to Switzerland. At the start of the game, all the players agree on an infamy score maximum, and as you accidentally kill patients, your infamy score rises. And once it reaches the agreed upon maximum, you're out of the game and the mob lynches you. So if the maximum is 10 and you're sitting at 8, you might want to head for the hills. The rules suggest using 6 as the max for a short game and 12 for a longer game. In phase 2, you draw from the deck until you have 6 cards again. In Phase 3, you draw a patient if you don't already have one and play it in front of you. Patient card has several stats that are important. The cure value lets you know how many cure points it will take to cure that patient. Under the artwork is a sentence listing the patient's complaint, and under that is a box listing the treatments that the patient needs to recover. There's also a kill score. If your treatments do more harm than good, and you exceed the kill score, that patient is toast. And then their infamy score is added to you. Some patients also have a mortal score, and if you play more treatments, each card is a treatment, numbering more than the mortal score, that also kills the patients. And again, you gain the infamy score.
Have I missed something along the way here? Is this game supposed to be set in, say, the 18th century or something?
Use hacksaw.
Leeches.
Where's my leeches, damn it? Now, during Phase 4, the player rolls a die, and you're looking for a number between 2 and 5. If you roll a 1 or a 6, you just re-roll. And during Phase 5, you must play that number of treatment cards on your patient this turn, even if it hurts the patient.
No. Yes.
Treatment cards are the cards in your hand, and they list a cost or amount of money that you earn if it cures the patient. It also lists which symptoms that they cure and which symptoms that they harm, and by how many points. You have to play the number of cards you rolled on the die, so sometimes you'll end up hurting the patient. And actually, it's a lot harder to cure a patient than it is to hurt them.
Well, I would assume that.
Right. You know, if you start giving heart medicine to a guy who's got bleeding trauma, it's not going to help him out too much.
Calling Dr. Miller, Dr. McAleer, Dr. Miller.
So you play your cards, you hope you have the ones that will cure him. If you do, you earn all the money. If you kill him, you earn the infamy. If you don't have enough treatment cards, you can play what you have. And the patient, if not cured or killed, holds on until your next turn and you'll get to treat them again. The only other card types that make up your hand are the anytime cards. And these can be played at when?
Very specific points of the game?
No, at any time.
Oh!
These can do things like cure the patient automatic, change the symptoms on an opponent's patient, and do other good and bad things. And Phase 6 is the angry mob phase. If your infamy score has reached the max, you lose and you're out of the game. When you're down to only 2 active players left, then you each take one more turn and the game's over. Each surviving player totals up their money earned, and the one with the highest total wins. Now there's good points and bad points to the game. First of all, we all hated having to play bad treatments on the patients. It did get a little annoying. More often than not, you're stuck with no choice and you end up killing 3 out of your 4 patients that you get in the whole game.
This has got to be the 15th century. Welcome to Dark Ages medicine.
Now, secondly, there's mostly luck in the game and not a lot of strategy. It all depends on the draw of the cards and the roll of the die. Thirdly, the rules are really short and a little bit unclear. How do you play with 2 players? I don't know. Because the game ends when you're down to 2 active players. So, I don't know. It doesn't say what you do if there's only 2.
If it's a 2-player game, you deal out the cards right. And the game's over.
Now, the nice thing about the game is that it's actually pretty interesting. You learn the actual treatments for the various conditions and what different common medications treat. Let me point out that the rules state, for the love of all that is good, please do not use any of the information from this game to treat yourself. And that's good advice. But it is still pretty interesting. I like treating the patients and trying to cure them. I just wish that I wasn't forced to kill so many. In the end, it is an interesting game. I like the theme. Keeping track of infamy and the money was a bit of a pain, and I don't like rolling the die to be forced to treat a patient a certain number of times.
Right.
The kids didn't like it. The adults liked it more. But again, it was annoying to be forced to kill so many patients. A few rule clarifications and some manipulation of the mechanics, and this game would be a big hit. I did find the premise pretty entertaining. Like I said, the young ones, nah, they didn't care for it all. Yeah, the teenagers, I should say. I shouldn't say young ones.
It doesn't sound up my alley either.
I did find it interesting. I did like the thought of like trying to cure these patients.
I do understand that. I just find it kind of strange because it sounds like it's supposed to be set.
It is
now.
It is,
I mean, you know, as if modern day medicine, where? Who would be a doctor who would possibly knock off 75% of the patients that they treat?
You get hit by an angry mob pretty fast.
I'm not sure if I have seen too many angry mobs out there attacking doctors. Guys,
torches, you know? Pitchforks.
Yeah, right.
I'll give it that. It was different. And like I said, the only thing I hated was having to kill everybody. I had trouble coming to grip with that. The same way you mentioned just now.
The final game we're going to take a look at is Fantasy Craft, the role-playing game. Published by Crafty Games, it is authored by Alex Flagg, Scott Guerin, and Patrick Capira. The second printing, which is what I'm doing a review of, came out in 2010. Obviously, it's a role-playing game, so you need at least two players, and really, there's never much of a limitation as far as
wait, does it come with dice?
Playing game, but
I'm just kidding. Sorry.
I know. No, I understand. I wouldn't expect a book to come no, with dice. It is 400 pages. It is a hardcover edition, and it retails for $49.99. We should point out that our trip to Gen Con exposed Elliot and I to a lot of different role-playing games and role-playing game companies that we weren't familiar with That's before we arrived. Obviously, we saw a lot of different titles and systems that didn't do anything to float our boats. But there were a handful that piqued our interest and did want to make us dig a little deeper into these releases. Fantasy Craft is one of those titles. It's essentially a high fantasy cousin to the Spycraft role-playing game system that was originally published over at AEG. Following the discontinuation of the Spycraft line in 2005, Patrick Capira and Alex Flagg joined forces and launched Crafty Games. One of Crafty's flagship titles is Fantasy Craft, thus the RPG's name, obviously. The rules make liberal use of the Open Gaming License. I'll be the first one to point out, I'm not real familiar exactly what the Open Gaming License is, simply because I'm not real big on reading page upon page of legalese. But mainly my understanding is that game companies have the opportunity to utilize the 3rd and 3.5 editions of Dungeons & Dragons and create a lot of different titles, different settings using that, as well as, I believe, the D20 system for
really?
Their frameworks.
I didn't know that at all.
Like I said, I'm not positive, but I believe simply because Wizards of the Coast was no longer going to support those two editions, they made it available. And of course, there's specifics in all that legalese.
You can't use the word
that,
thief.
You know, I don't know. I don't think that's it.
You can't say level.
I was going to say, you can't use the word thief, but you can utilize the word lawyer. Just kidding. It's a joke. I believe that's how the Open Gaming License works. I'm not sure. I'm being honest. I don't know. And I could find out if I did want to sit and sift through umpteen pages of what is the Open Gaming License. So I guess it's more along the lines of kind of Creative Commons. Of course, hardcore role players have experienced the D20 system or some variation of it at some point over the years. So using this as the basis for Fantasy Craft certainly did make sense. Normally, players of Dungeons & Dragons find their adventuring tied to officially released materials and settings, as this provides a lot of comfort for many gamers because they can play with different GMs and know that there are globally accepted concepts. Spells, monsters, abilities, they'll all perform uniformly. This approach, in my opinion, also restricts what you can do within the D&D system to a certain degree. Dungeons & Dragons, as we now know it, really isn't a sandbox environment. This is where a game like Fantasy Craft comes into play, because it's really a toolkit designed for gamers, and especially GMs, that are creatively minded but feel more comfortable playing in a sandbox using tools that provide consistency and balance. Your dungeon, your dragon, your way is a tagline used by Crafty, and it really does hold true as there are loads of options in the game. Character creation starts by picking one of 12 races and 12 character classes. Fantasy Craft has a pretty respectable list of playable races, even those that most players would kind of scratch their heads at because they tend to be monster types, ogres, orcs, and giants. There's some very unusual races that offer a challenge not only to role play, but also to include in a standard fantasy adventure. The amoeba. There you go. That's what you do. You read the rules too.
I'm going to be the amoeba.
I will play the pond scum.
Hold on, I'm going to replicate.
Of course, the races I'm talking about are not amoebas or pond scum. They're drakes, which are smaller cousins of dragons, root walkers, which are walking, talking trees, and, oddly enough, the unborn, which are living machines or constructs, like a golem or something like that.
I understand.
No, I know. I thought...
Battle of the fetuses.
The title for that... Yeah, exactly. The unborn. Playing the amoeba, and I'm playing the sperm cell. Each of the races have their own unique list of advantages and disadvantages that break down to more than just a simple addition or subtraction to a base attribute. You'll even find that humans have been given a lot of thought to make them more attractive to play, because there's a list of talents for human characters to choose from. Character classes are dealt with in a pretty interesting manner as well, as each of the base classes, assassin, courtier, soldier, so forth, receives a specialty which details more of the background and how your character approaches their class. For an example, are you a bloodthirsty assassin ready to snuff out a target if the price is right? Or are you a fantasy world version of Frank Castle, punishing wrongdoers? There are lots of ways to create a character in which no two of the same class are alike. Once you finish creating that character, you'll feel as if you've put together an adventurer that has a life of their own. Not to continue going on and on about the game, I will mention that the mechanics of the Fantasy Craft system are solid, and much is made of adding or subtracting rules that will best fit into how you like to play or run your games. There's plenty here to make your vision as tactically heavy or story-driven as you'd like. If you're overly concerned with how characters can grapple each other to the ground, knock yourself out. The rules are here at your disposal. On the other hand, if you aren't concerned with that level of detail, you can ignore those rules completely. I'm one of those people who would ignore those rules completely. Two items I point out that I found of interest are the armor rules as well as health and healing. One thing I never understood about Dungeons & Dragons, as well as many other role-playing systems, is the concept that depending on what sort of armor your character might be wearing determines how difficult they are to hit in combat. Landing a hit and scoring damage are tied together with the armor class mechanic. In reality, someone in a leather jerkin would actually be harder to strike than someone weighed down in full mail or plate armor, due to maneuverability and greater range of vision of the person with leather jerkin. Dealing damage, on the other hand, would be a different story. Fantasy Craft gets this right, as characters will have a resistance to various types of damage according to their armor, and also have a separate defense score indicating the difficulty or ease in which they could be bashed with a weapon. Damage and healing is dealt with by breaking hit points into two pools, vitality and wounds. Most damage is drawn from vitality, as this pool will increase with level advancement. Vitality will normally be exhausted before a character begins to lose wounds, although there are types of damage that are applied directly to the character as wounds, and you don't risk being killed right off the bat. Another aspect of D&D I never could get my head around was, as a character advanced in level, the number of hit points they would have increases. So does that mean that a level 2 character has twice the mass of a first level character? Of course not. Vitality and wounds makes much more sense. Vitality is recovered rather quickly, so players don't have to come up with inventive ways to roleplay downtime in order to recover from each pitched battle or hard-fought encounter. At 400 pages, Fantasy Craft is loaded with tons of info in which to hone your role-playing setting to your own personal preference. There's chapters for building your own unique world and setting, crafting monsters and non-player characters, spells and spellcraft, and so on. Any role player would be hard-pressed to find any important aspect of a full-fledged RPG system missing within the pages of this rulebook, while everything needed by players and GMs is contained right there at your fingertips. You don't ever have to buy another
book. You know, it is a nice-looking book.
It is a really really nicely presented book. There's loads of artwork. It's a really nice hardcover edition. You know, a lot of times you'll get these hardcover RPGs where you go through the book one time and you already see that the binding's coming apart. No, not at all. I mean, this is, granted, it's a $50 book, which isn't unusual as far as role-playing games are nowadays. Back in the day when we did a lot of role-playing, you would probably pick up a hardcover book for $15, something like that. I forget what the original, I think the original Monster Manual for D&D, I think maybe I picked that up. It was like $12. But then again, it wasn't 400 pages long either. But it is, it's a really well-presented book, and it's not just an interesting alternative to more well-known fantasy RPGs, because it's a lot of fun, and it's a thought-provoking read. Throughout the book, the authors aren't telling you how you have to create your world, but they challenge you to ask yourself questions about the kind of game you'd like to play or run. And there's an underlying sense of fun that runs throughout the rulebook, too. And that begins with the artwork and ends with the overall sense of encouraging the reader to run wild with the concepts that are contained within. I'll be very honest, though, it's not groundbreaking as it's based on that open gaming license, but there are loads of nuggets that can be mined by those who are set in their role-playing systems. You might be able to find a lot of great stuff in Fantasy Craft that you'd want to add to your own role-playing system that you already use. It might be a little too open for beginning GMs, though, because it does require a creative and dedicated game master. Because it is a sandbox setting, there is a bigger investment of time to create a rewarding setting than just going out there and picking up, let's say, Pathfinder or D&D, where the adventures are already all put together for you. It's a well-detailed sandbox for fantasy role players. It's got a lot of fun artwork. I enjoyed reading it. It was one of the few role-playing games that I've run across as of late where I really wanted to get to the next section and see what was in store. Huh.
That sounds pretty good. You know, next time we run into these guys, we got to try to get them to run us through a setting or something.
The next time we run across these guys?
Alex and Patrick?
That's just kind of funny the way you're like, well, you know, the next time we run across these guys, as if we bump into them downtown Chicago or they're out here.
They're pretty nice guys. We sat and chatted with them at Gen Con.
They were. You had a
for the second time.
Interview, right. You had the interview for the second time, yes, because we originally did interview them at Gen Con. But we really enjoyed talking with them so much that you followed up after we had some technical difficulties. You followed up with them to make sure that we did get a good interview with them. I think this is a blast. I think it's a great pickup for those out there who are into the fantasy setting. And there are a few other source books that I have that I'll probably be tackling on the website doing some reviews of as well. So yeah, a big thumbs up for Fantasy Craft. I thought it was really a blast. So I believe that should bring us to the end.
It's true. I'm so sorry it's over again.
There's just nothing left.
There's nothing, man.
Nothing left for us. All right, my friend. Fortunately, we are a little late in getting this recorded this weekend, so we are going to end up being a couple of days late, which people listening to this will already know. But we do apologize for the delay, but I hope you enjoyed the show. And until next time, Elliot, care to take us out?
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.